welcome to another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the next half hour, and this week's episode is entitled All Roads Lead to Rome. Week we're looking at films that are set in the Italian capital, Rome. For a couple of reasons. One, there are many fantastic and very important movies that are set there. One very personal favourite of mine. I've been wanting to talk about it on this show pretty much since its inception two or three years ago I've been doing this show. But also, is it because I just went there and I'm interested in talking about it? Maybe. I'm not sure. But basically, it's a fantastic topic to talk about if you do a show on movies, because there are so many big, as I said before, so many big Italian filmmakers over the years. And we're talking about three pretty big ones today and three pretty big films. But if you've never been to Rome, you're not interested in Rome, I think this is still an interesting episode to talk about, because what is it that Rome represents, not only just in these films, but generally when we talk about it, we use that phrase, you know, all roads lead to Rome, or we talk about, you know, when in Rome, or Rome wasn't built in a day, or when, you know, all that sort of stuff. Yeah, Rome, I suppose, in the culture, kind of represents the starting point of Western civilization. And it's kind of like not a time capsule, but it's kind of like a way in which we can kind of like, a barometer, but a metric or a measure. It's sort of the way that Rome is going is kind of the way that sort of depicts sort of the tide moving up and down, or the way that Western civilization has sort of moved. Within Rome, we sort of see the whole history of the West in a way. Or at least we can project the future of Western civilization or Western culture. You know, I mean, Marcus Aurelius famously said, "If you want to know the future of all empires, look at how Rome will turn out at the time he was still going when he was there." But it's kind of got this starting point of Western civilization element to it. It's also in that sense, kind of in modern films, it's kind of like a vestige of the first great civilization as well. So as I said before, it kind of plays into that, like, well, you know, what's the future of great civilizations? But we can't skip over the fact that it's arguably, you know, it's the home of arguably the most powerful institution, at least monetarily speaking. The Catholic Church is one of the most powerful institutions in the world, if not in history. It's also a cultural epicenter, just in terms of its relics and its artifacts and just the general arts and cultural scene that exists in Rome. You know, as I said before, so many great filmmakers have come from there. It's, you know, Italy is the home of opera. So many things come out of that place. And then, you know, it's also sort of just a pinnacle of modern cosmopolitan culture, which is certainly something that's depicted in at least one of the films we're going to be talking about, if you haven't guessed what it is already. The first one we're going to talk about is Rossellini's 1945 film Rome, Open City. We're then going to move on to my personal favourite of pretty much everybody's, I think, that's seen it, is Federico Fellini's La Dolce Vita, starring Marcello Mastroianni from 1960. And then we're going to finish off with a Sorrentino film. And if you're going to do a film that directed by Sorrentino that's based in Rome, of course it's going to be not The Great Beauty, because we've already, fans of the show, and we've actually already talked about that on the show, and I don't like to talk about the same film more than once just because I don't want to go over the same territory. Will we kind of get into the same territory? Maybe we will, but the film we're going to talk about is Sorrentino's 2008 film Il Divo, which is about the events that occurred in the early 90s in Italian politics concerning Giulio Andreotti. But let's get things started with Rossellini's 1945 film Rome, Open City. And if you haven't seen this one, basically it kind of follows the actions of the resistance fighters that kind of fought back against the Nazis during their occupation of Italy in the second half of the Second World War, let's say. And in a funny kind of way, it's kind of the, we're going to kind of start off with the exception to the rule in terms of how it depicts Rome. In terms of, you know, Rome is, if you think about sort of a Roman holiday, which we've also talked about on the show before, La Dolce Vita, which we're about to talk about in a second, you know, depictions of Rome generally is that sort of cosmopolitan capital, you know, arts, history, music, food, that sort of thing. Rome, Open City talks about Rome. You can kind of tell from the title of the film, it depicts Rome as this ironically tragic depiction of Rome, yet it still kind of is recoverable. The fate of Rome is still sort of recoverable. You know, it's one of the once great empires that's kind of fallen to become an open city. But then it is still somewhat recoverable in the film. We're going to sort of look at all those elements, all those two sort of major elements. Now, so in its most basic sense, I suppose what we could say is that this film is kind of like an important telling or potentially a rectification, depending on how you view what Italy did and the Italian people did during the Second World War, but in a telling of their history during the war, that they fought back. And so it's the title of the film is kind of doubly ironic in a way. It's ironic in the first sense that, if you're not aware what an open city is in the context of war, which actually I didn't know what it was until I saw the film. But in war, an open city is like a town or a city which is announced as abandoned of all defensive efforts. So it's sort of to say that you can come in and take over. We're not going to fight back. You can kind of take it. So the first sort of ironic aspect of the title of the film is that it's not an open city because there were resistance fighters that fought back and do fight back in the film. But it's also got a thing. There's another ironic aspect to it, which is probably more to do with what we're talking about this week, which is that calling Rome, of all cities, an open city is kind of ironic. It's because, Rome is, historically one of the great fortresses of the Western civilization. Rome ruled all over the place at a time. And sort of to call Rome, of all cities, an open city is a degree of humor to that. And so we're sort of starting off this week with the exception to the rule to say, well, why would a film, or why would Rossellini want to depict a film, or what's the effect of depicting Rome, which was previously this robust fortress, as this, the depiction of the city is it's full of rubble and it's dark and grimy and gross and the Nazis are walking all through it and everyone's sort of living off rations and hardly getting by. So this profound fall from grace, is it recoverable? What's some of the sort of the deeper effects of this film, let's say? Well, I want to talk about how it's kind of got this noirish, there's a kind of a noirish vibe to this film. It's got a noirish kind of depiction of Rome. So obviously the film's set in 1945 and a lot of films around this sort of budget and that sort of thing just look that way, and that's what films look like in 1945, and it's just in black and white, that sort of thing. But there is this motif of like espionage and conspiracy in the film. So there's traitors, like you have in a lot of war films, and so obviously we see that amongst the bad guys. But I think what's probably more significant in talking about this film is the conspiratorial nature of the relationships of the good guys in the film, namely the religious, the priest figure, and the main guy, the atheist, the communist guy, who happens to be an atheist. And we're going to kind of touch on a similar note that we talked about last week. We talked about Monkey Man and the kind of the virtue of solidarity and bravery, the power of the solidarity of the downtrodden and kind of swarming together, and the roots sort of grabbing everybody and making the full body. But I think this depiction of the priest and the communist who's an atheist sort of coming together to be the saviors of Rome kind of sort of says that when you get to the bottom of the trough, and this is truly the bottom, right? If that Rome was so powerful once upon a time, to then be brought to its knees to this extent, this once great capital being brought to its knees by fascists. There's sort of like this, and this is going to be a concept I think we talk about it quite a lot in this week's episode, is that there's almost like this kind of divine spirit in humanity that transcends individual belief systems like fascism or Catholicism or communism on its own. It kind of transcends ideology, transcends dogma, and that's the thing that saves innocent people from the constraints or the suffocation of something like fascism. So it is something we kind of touched on when we talked about The Great Beauty, when we talked about that film many months ago, and we talked about it. And it's going to be a concept that we talk about a bit later, but there's almost this idea, this sort of enduring sense of right that transcends human artificially constructed ideologies, words written down on a piece of paper, that there's something divine that even in the perils of a war-torn Rome and between people that don't traditionally get along, i.e. religious types and atheists, when under the foot, under the boot of someone as suffocating as a fascist, we can kind of derive some kind of mutual understanding of the right despite our differences, despite the fact that we're huddling together in a war-torn, rubble-filled city. There's a sense that there's some mutual value, some mutual ideals that we can both not only identify, but find some solidarity over and use as the engine or the fuel to fight back against these fascists. So when you watch the film, that is sort of a main focus of this film is that these two guys can get together and find something to work out. And it's quite seamless, and it doesn't actually take too much tension or contradiction between the two. It's very clear that the enemy is the fascist, and they're able quite easily to swarm together and come out from within these shadows of this sort of noir depiction of a war-torn Rome. But sort of as mentioned previously, this is sort of the exception to the rule. All those descriptions of Rome being something filled with rubble and it being a war-torn place is not really how we understand Rome. As I mentioned before, that Rome Open City, the title in the film itself, is almost an ironic depiction of Rome. How is Rome usually depicted, or perhaps how is it more traditionally depicted? Well, before we get into our next film, just to remind you, I listen to 2XX 98.3 People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, presenting Sacred Cinema for the remainder of this half hour. Be sure to stay tuned for more quality radio program here on 2XX, and jump onto our website if you're not there already to subscribe to the station or sponsor the show. But let's move on now to our second film. It's Fellini's La Dolce Vita from 1960. I've been meaning to talk about this film on this show for so long, and I don't want to do it dirty, so let's get into it. If you haven't seen it, it's basically like an episodic tale. It's almost like a big catalogue of short films that centre on this devilishly handsome and philandering journalist/writer named Marcello, played by the very famous and equally handsome Marcello Mastroianni. And I'm going to talk about how I think it sort of depicts Rome as this taunting and... Rome is kind of like a taunting and almost kind of tense in all its temptations and tests, let's say. We've talked about all those things before, about how it's an artistic hub, how there's a religious underpinning to it, obviously it's war-torn. There's a lot going on in Rome, and it can pull a person in many different directions. So let's firstly touch on this sort of episodic structure of the film. In a way, it makes the film really hard to follow what it's about. I don't think this is a film where you can really say La Dolce Vita is about this. It's just one of those, you know, Fellini's just like that, and you know, there's also different interpretations of this film, but equally I think the beauty of this one, one of the beauties of this film, is that in having that kind of episodic unstructured structure, very accurately depicts what Marcello's psyche is in the film, which is that, as kind of already discussed and just touched on it again, you know, Rome is not simply just like a foodie's paradise that's filled with lovely Catholic churches and fountains and that. It's those things, but it's also a war-torn, beaten-up city with slums, with sex workers who are impoverished, with degenerates, with liars, with the elite, the selfish elite, and the paparazzi, which we'll focus on a little bit more in a second. So it's everything. It's so many things all at once. And to put it simply, I think the film is a very, very Italian meditation on that very existential tension between, you know, seeking the indulgent life or the sweet life or the high life or, you know, a life of indulgence versus seeking a life that's purely virtuous and putting the work in. This is something we've talked about a lot on the show before. Unsurprisingly, the film was released in the exact same year as Carell Rise's Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, which we talked about in one of the very first episodes of Sacred Cinema. And I think it's kind of like, it's really funny to compare the two, because one's like the very Italian depiction of this tension and one's the very English depiction of this tension, where it's a guy who goes to a factory and he's got two girls, he can't pick which one. Like, you couldn't have, you know, like, it's quite funny to think how different these films are in terms of their style, but thematically how similar they are. They come out both in 1960. And I think the main way we see this tension is in Marcello's constant pursuit of beautiful women despite his fiancée, and in this constant chase for women and having to come to terms with the fact that, you know, you can, in the same way that Saturday Night and Sunday Morning depicts that idea of, you know, do you either settle with one person or work hard at it, or do you keep going after the shiny girl that you know, wears the beautiful dress and has the earrings and might be fun for a night, but there's no sort of serious or difficulty in engaging in that relationship. But also paralleling this, of course, is the dilemma that he faces in his professional life, on the sort of the broader sort of his ambition, which is that he has the sort of he's tested by having to be a sort of serious writer. He knows deep down that that's probably something he ought to do, maybe. But then he's also this paparazzi-fueled journalist who makes quick bucks out of taking photos of celebrities and things like that. And those sort of parallel, and obviously the scenes with the Swedish girl, I've forgotten her name, but you go, you know, going through the trivia fountain and everything like that is, you know, paralleling his pursuit of the lavish and the kind of superficially beautiful versus, you know, being a serious writer and that sort of thing. And one of the best aspects of this film, and what makes it so much more than just sort of like a two-dimensional film about, you know, do you work hard in life or do you have fun, is that it's really not as simple as saying that this kind of sweet, high life, luxurious, materialistic life is simply a hurdle that stands between Marcello and what he ought to do. I think I said before what he, you know, he ought to be good, right? It's not that simple, because you've got that the character of Steiner, who I think makes this film sort of lifts it up that extra level that it needs to be in that, which is a stupid thing for me to say about this movie, but you get what I mean, that this life of traditional virtues and hard work is not really depicted as such a great thing by the end of this film. But then again, neither is, you know, that kind of Peter Pan lifestyle that Marcello also contemplates. So it's not as simple as saying that, you know, this sweet life, sipping lattes in cafes and chasing beautiful women is simply an obstacle to living a good life and discipline is the only way to go. A disciplined life can also, you know, crumble a soul. And so it really does play into that tension very, very nicely. So what's Marcello to do? Is this film just sort of kind of like a nihilistic, depressing film by the end of it? Or I want to talk now about this motif of the paparazzi briefly. And in some ways, it doesn't really fit into what I'm saying, but I actually think it does, because ultimately, this if you haven't seen the film, his friend, the word paparazzi actually comes from this movie, because his friend, Marcello's friend, whose name is Paparazzo, keeps running around and taking photos of celebrities and people who have gone through tragedies. And he's a bit of a nuisance, and all the guys with the photos are a bit of a nuisance. And it kind of gives us this sense, or at least it gives me a sense, that there's a degree of... there's obviously this exploitative degree, aspect of the paparazzi, but probably better put, there's a kind of a pathetic kind of obsession involved in gawking at or looking up at, you know, the rich and famous. Like, and that's kind of what we actually do. There's a degree of breaking the fourth wall in this film, because it's kind of what we do when we look at Marcello Mastroianni walking around with his fantastic haircut and his sunglasses, smoking cigarettes in his in his fancy suit. Like, there's something pathetic about looking at someone else's life through the lens of a camera and being like, oh, that's so good, and sort of living vicariously through a movie screen or on a magazine or something like that. Because by the end of this film, I don't think you watch this film and you can't help but feel that the true tragedy of Marcello's situation is that he had this kind of inability, as hard as it was, he kind of had this inability to kind of take the right action at the right time, we might say. But the emphasis is on action, actually doing something, making the effort to do what he needs to do, and kind of base his life and decisions around specifically kind of like being with the right people or the person that's really at the top of this heap. You know, in this kind of, the film's almost got this Nashville, like Robert Altman kind of vibe, where there's so many different quirky characters and people going on, but you can't help but feel by the end of the film, you know, there's a single person he almost puts above them all or respects more or kind of wishes would think highly of him above all else. And it is a little bit hard to put to words, and that's why it's important you actually watch films rather than just sit at a microphone and talk about them. But it's almost like that there's this temptation to look at those who live the high life and who look beautiful, and it, that we can, you know, it feels warm to look at fancy people, you know, on Instagram or something like that. But ultimately, there are other kind of like more genuine or humble or authentic, and sometimes even just downright ordinary people out there who we actually put higher on the heap. And we almost sort of regret losing touch with if you lose touch with that more authentic person that is sort of genuinely virtuous and beautiful in their own way, and beautiful in a sort of pure, unmanufactured way. And so again, sort of, I guess the first scene of this film also depicts this really well because obviously we can't not talk about the depiction of Christ in sort of talking about, you know, the idea of looking for someone who's more genuine and humble and authentic. Like, this is the archetypally Christ-like figure in a non-romantic sense, and this depiction of the Christ statue at the beginning, I think is very deserving of a mention here, where rather than looking for that in the second helicopter, if you've seen the film, Marcello looks to the rooftop with the girls in the bikinis and is distracted by that. Like it's almost to say that we know that there is a person that we should pursue. There's a person that we deep down do, you know, whether he's religious or not doesn't really make a difference. There is a person that we deep down should seek their approval of. And the most important thing is not to lose track of that, not to get caught up in the circus of who's famous and what's going on, not to commercialize these things, but to be genuine about it. You know, not necessarily. I'm going down a rabbit hole there. I think the point's made there, because to sort of compare it to Rome, Open City, briefly, before we move into our next film. In Rome, we've got this sort of rubble-filled hellhole begging for the action of a courageous few who can fuse together over these sort of shared ideals. But then in the La Dolce Vita, it's more that Rome is like this tease that potentially distracts us from those sacred things and that we should really care about. It's almost like when it's in a state of war-tornness, it's easier to find the things that we ought to get around. And when it's filled with cafes and beautiful women, we get distracted by that and we sort of have that sort of sense of guilt around abandoning those things. But so is there a film that kind of maybe reconciles those two depictions and maybe gives them both some weight? Well, let's finish off now with Mr. Paolo Sorrentino's 2008 film Il Divo. And if you haven't seen this one, it follows the events concerning Giulio Andreotti, who was a prime minister, I think he was like seven times in Italy throughout the 20th century, late 20th century. And it follows what was going on with him in the early 90s when he was facing charges of being involved with the mafia and killing a journalist and that sort of thing. And it's quite ironically titled, if you don't know, Il Divo is a reference to Julius Caesar. And so if you read up on Andreotti, he was sort of called that because he sort of had a kind of, he was a very religious guy and kind of had this divine quality to him in that sense, or like had put a lot of pressure on, put a lot of weight on his religious beliefs. And there's a whole thing in the film about he doesn't believe in chance, but the will of God. But he obviously isn't a god. Like you're calling someone that is calling someone divine who's clearly a human being, and if you look at pictures of him, it's kind of ironic. But sort of playing off what we've been talking about already, I think it does follow on from what Rome Open City kind of does in a way, without sort of being obvious in any kind of references to it. But it again, Sorrentino in his sort of classic, in his style, sort of does depict Rome as this somewhat noirish place. And looking at sort of the political sphere of it, and if you go to Rome, it is a very political city. And look at all of the, if you go to certain neighborhoods and all the big grandiose political buildings and the Quirinale and all those things. But in a very sort of typical Sorrentino style, with the lighting, it's almost got this modern chiaroscuro Caravaggio sort of shadowy. I mean, the very first shot of Andreotti, he's there's almost like this shadowy vignette. And he's in the middle, and he's surrounded by darkness, and he's kind of like lurking like a little Nosferatu type. But also in terms of this kind of noirishy kind of vibe, it's got this kind of Scorsese-esque gangster feel to it, this film, where all the hits, all the people that get killed, it does feel a bit like The Irishman or Goodfellas and something like that. And also just in the characterization of Andreotti himself, we don't really find out much about whether he actually did what he did or what he did. There's an aura of mystery about kind of in every kind of aspect of how this film is made. But then kind of on the other hand, it's not completely grimy and dirty like Rome Open City. There's a sleekness to it that pays respect to sort of other depictions of Rome, like in La Dolce Vita or in the Great Beauty. Again, in a way that Sorrentino can only do, where it's very sleek. It's a very sleek film. It's very smooth, not just in its camera works, but the costumes. Everyone's dressed to the nines, and they look like they're in beautiful Armani suits, or I don't know the people, but everyone looks really good. It's a kind of cool-looking movie. Sorrentino does it better than anybody. And I was like, just like the general performances of the film, like he's an old, wrinkly old man, but like he's kind of like, it's very soft, it's very contemplative. There's almost like an ASMR-y vibe to the film. So I was to say that modern Rome could almost be characterized as still a very sleek and fashionable and beautiful place, despite the fact that it feels like something always remains lurking in the shadows, something beyond what we can see, a sort of divine but not quite divine thing that we can't see or feel with our hands, but we know it's there. I guess the question is, what is that thing? Well, let's recap. So in Rome Open City, we talk about how Rome was this once great fortress, but it was brought to its knees once the Roman Empire fell, and well after that, but in the Second World War and that sort of thing. And it's sort of in the late 1940s, it was sort of, the end of the Second World War, it was begging for a kind of solidarity among unlikely allies. It needed people to fuse over something that was greater than their own personal ideologies. But perhaps on more of like an individual level, 20 odd years later, Rome is this tempestuous and teasing city that can lure even the best of us into these kind of rabbit holes that distract us from those truly important desires that do transcend material desires. And it's not that as easy as being disciplined and just going about your work. It's something that just seems sort of outside of, out of our grasp, something that we can't quite hear, that can't quite resonate and reach us. So perhaps these ideas actually do go hand in hand a bit more than we might first think, you know, that the profound powers of Rome's sleek and beautiful elite, be they financial elites or cultural elites or religious elites, is kind of mysteriously hidden in places that we can't quite see. And perhaps in future depictions of Rome on the screen, you know, there'll be a bit of fervor, you know, a bit more fervor of the revolutionaries of the 1940s, the anti-fascists who will show their hand and fight back against this kind of mysterious power, these mysterious sources of power that hide behind the curtains. Or perhaps it'll go the other way. Perhaps this kind of mysterious hidden pattern, this mysterious hidden power will perhaps be sort of examined and justified, and maybe the everyman will try and wield it somehow. Maybe there's something that uniquely divine. Maybe there is something divine about it. Maybe there's something that the common man should get around. You know, maybe it's something that can be found and can be taken on by everybody. I suppose rather than speculating about what future films might look like, why don't we just look at the films that we actually talk about? You know, what are some of the common aspects of them? Well, I'm going to kind of double down now on what I said when we talked about The Great Beauty, the other Sorrentino film many, many episodes ago. I don't think you can't help but notice that, and you can't help but notice when you walk around Rome itself as well, that there's a continual religious motif, specifically a Catholic motif in all of these films and all throughout Rome itself. So even without turning to whether Rossellini, Fellini or Sorrentino were or actually are Catholic, and only one actually was, you can't help but admit there's at least some form of presence in all of these films and many other of all of their films of some kind of like a Catholic presence. I'm not here saying that, you know, Catholicism is the be all and end all. I'm not trying to say that, but perhaps this is what people mean when they talk about Catholic guilt. Like it just hovers there. Even if you reject it, it hovers there. It's almost like, you know, even if these a major city like Rome, you know, which has its, with all its religious institutions or you know, its political institutions or its massive cultural institutions, there seems to be some enduring kind of timeless ideological place that's underpinned by ideas and values that'll never go away. We can't help but shape them. We can't help but shake them. And even if we reject this place, you know, that somehow, and I'm not saying it's a church, I'm not saying it's the Vatican, but it feels like there's some kind of there's coming out of place that transcends the material. There's somewhere that's underpinned by these ageless, timeless ideas. Even if we want to reject that, we're still turning our minds to this place. It's almost as if no matter what road we travel on, we can't help but end up there. That's all I've got time for this week on Sacred Cinema. Thank you so much for joining us here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. Be sure to stay tuned for more quality radio programming if you're listening live. But also, if you're listening online, consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring the show. And also consider getting in contact with me. You can email me at contact@jimmyvernasconi.com with any thoughts, feedback, or recommendations for the show. And I guess we'll see you again next week. Thanks so much for tuning in.